From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Is it time to reform education reform? Hello again, I'm Oren Almy, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The No Child Left Behind Act was supposed to make every American kid proficient in reading and math by 2014. But after 5 years, that sounds like a pipe dream. Proficiency standards differ wildly from state to state. Some tests are being made easier so that scores will go up. Schools that have not improved are not being held accountable. And angry parents in many places have gone to court. On To the Point, is it time for national standards? Are test scores the best measures? What about merit pay for teachers? We'll talk about those and other issues and update the fires in California. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. President Bush wants Congress to renew No Child Left Behind, but after 5 years, there is little consensus left on education reform. On To the Point, how well is it working? What's needed to make it better? We'll hear a variety of different points of view. First, this news update. Fires continue to rage in seven Southern California counties from Ventura to the Mexican border. With his microphone buffeted by winds in Malibu, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger summarized the situation so far.
Now, all across Southern California, we have seven counties with fires so far. Tens of thousands of acres have burned. Thousands of buildings have been threatened. We've been evacuating residents in harm's way. And extremely dangerous heavy winds and dry conditions make it very, very hard to get those fires under control.
The governor, who has declared states of emergency in seven Southern California counties. Kim DeVore is a staff writer for the Malibu Times and also a resident of Malibu. Kim, you certainly got the worst of it yesterday. What about today?
Oh, it's been crazy. Hi, Warren. We used to work at Channel 13 together back in the day. It's been a while, but hello. And, you're seeing me again under really, really stressful circumstances. I've been a writer here at the Malibu Times for over 10 years. I've been a resident for 15. I've never seen anything quite as bad as this. I mean, we did have the 93 fire where, over 300 homes burned in that Rambla Vista area, which is across the street from my house. But you never saw anything where it was just so completely willy-nilly and flying all over the place. Nobody can really get a handle on it. There are these embers that are burning like crazy, and everybody's been extremely worried about this one.
300 homes that burned in 1993. Yesterday, there were three or four homes burned, a church, a famous castle that's visible from Pacific Coast Highway. What about other houses today?
Well, they're actually, the winds, it's really hot. It is really windy, but we've been fortunate. The winds didn't kick up quite as badly as we were fearing last night. So it's touch and go. I mean, it's exhausting. Everybody is, sort of ready to evacuate. My car is all, filled with stuff and, to just get the animals and get out. Right now at the Times, and if we have to cut this interview short, there are flames just on the hill above the above our office here. So everybody is really ready to go at any moment, and we're just at the mercy of the winds and this erratic fire situation.
Kim DeVore, a staff writer at the Malibu Times, tell us what you see when you look up the hill at those flames.
Well, if you've been in Malibu long enough, that if you see white smoke, that's probably a good sign. If you see black smoke, that usually means it's a building. That's not a good sign. Right now, we're seeing white smoke. However, it's burning very, very close to John Cosentino's house. They're a family out here. They own a group of floral shops. And they're also very, very long-time residents. He's been here for, I was just talking to him earlier, he's been here for over 34 years, and, you know, he just says, you know, he's shaking and he's got a knot in his stomach, and it just, you know, no matter how long you've been here, no matter how many times you go through this, it's still very, very, you know, it causes you a great deal of anxiety because you know you're powerless in a way.
You're close to the road in that office, obviously. Does the fire frequently come down to the Pacific Coast Highway?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I've lived on the beach side for many, many years, and you do get a false sense of security. I know that all oftentimes we'd go, oh, well, it never crosses the road. It never burns down to the beach. It's been burning down the road. It's been burning to the beach. And if you recall, something that really shook up a lot of us, you know, a lot of the old-timers, was the Malibu Road Fire, which was recently where Suzanne Summers' home completely burned to the ground, and that was, you know, that was right on the beach. So it's very unusual to see those flames cross the highway and start burning on the beach. And I think that what I can make out of it is it's just these ridiculously extremely dry fire conditions that we have, this horrible, horrible drought, and everything is so dry.
Is there fire on the beach side of the highway?
I'm not sure if there's anything burning at this moment. There was yesterday. People had decks that caught on fire. I saw, like, people out at producer David Geffen's house, is one of my neighbors there, and they were spraying it down. I was spraying down my deck. It crossed the highway and it went on the beach.
So obviously that's the worst of all possible worlds. Not happening at the moment. Winds, as you say, have died down a bit, but you never know what's going to happen later in the day.
Yeah, and you know, another thing that really worries us is that this is not the end of our Santa Ana condition. It's really just the beginning. We've got wind advisories until at least tomorrow night at 6 p.m., but you know, we're collectively breathing a little bit of a sigh of relief, but, you know, we know that can, you know, things can change very, very,
okay,
very quickly.
Kim DeVore, again, a staff writer at the Malibu Times and resident of Malibu. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks, Warren. Nice talking to you.
In a moment, we'll get a brief overview of what's happening elsewhere in California. Then we'll hear about efforts to renew and improve No Child Left Behind, the president's signature diplomatic accomplishment on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Malibu is hardly the only place in Southern California to be hit by raging brush fires. Once again, Governor Schwarzenegger has declared states of emergency in seven counties from Ventura to the Mexican border. Just to review what the governor said a moment ago, tens of thousands of acres have been burned. Thousands of buildings have been threatened. We know a number have been destroyed. Residents are being evacuated, those who are in harm's way, some of them preventatively, some of them on a voluntary basis, some of them required to leave. There are extremely dangerous winds and very dry conditions that are making it very hard for firefighters coming from all over the state to get the blazes under control. Here is the mayor of San Diego, Jerry Saunders.
We're asking people to stay off the roads, to stay at home. If you're in an area that could be affected, please pack your car, be ready to evacuate on a moment's notice. And finally, if you could minimize cell phone usage, that would be extremely helpful to our emergency personnel. They're using cell phones as one of the primary means of communication. If the cell sites load up, that means they don't have that ability to do that.
Once again, Jerry Saunders, the mayor of San Diego. Mark Jackson is meteorologist in charge of the National Weather Service forecast for the Los Angeles region. And Mark Jackson, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Something like 450,000 people have been evacuated in San Diego County, we understand. This is a very widespread phenomenon. What can you tell us about it? What causes it, and how long is it likely to last?
Well, fairly simply stated, high pressure off to our east, off into the Great Basin, builds in, and that dome of high pressure then causes these extremely strong winds easterly winds, Santa Ana winds, that then accelerate as they come down the slope into all the way out in the coastal areas and even out to the ocean.
So this is really from one side of the state to the other, from east to west.
It's mostly concentrated, again, on kind of this side of the mountains. What happens is you get this acceleration of winds actually down the slope, and which heightens their speeds. So it's mostly as you go from the center of the state out to the coast and out to the ocean.
So again, then it's just the coastal regions that are directly affected, but the phenomenon is over a very wide area.
That's correct. That's correct. The dome of high pressure that really is causing this is quite a ways off to our east, in the Great Basin.
Now, 200,000 houses were lost just 4 years ago in the San Diego area. There's some talk that this one could be even worse than that. What can you tell us about the likelihood that areas of high population concentration are going to be hit?
Well, right now, when we consider the combination of extremely dry conditions that we've had 2 years ago, we did have a fairly wet winter. Last winter, it was fairly dry, almost at least in downtown Los Angeles. It was the driest on record. When you talk about a summer to a summer, which is considered the rainy season, it was the driest ever last winter. So we have very dry fuels out there, and we've known now for quite a few days that we would get these extremely strong winds. And these winds are exceptionally strong. When you consider that we've had wind speed reports up in the mountains of over 100 miles an hour, even as you go farther west out toward the coast, we've had wind speeds of over 7 miles an hour, which is hurricane-strength winds. Very dry air, relative humidities in the single digits, and it's just a recipe for disaster.
So when the weather is like this, then there are millions of people living in a fire zone.
Absolutely, absolutely, and it's kind of the price we pay for living out here. But even prior to the onset of the winds yesterday, we were in coordination with the fire agencies, and the whole intent of this program and this partnership is to allow the fire agencies and the local state and officials to really ramp up for something like this.
There are a lot of fire agencies involved, as you say. A lot of them are local, municipal, county, and state, and they're national firefighters as well. Do they go through your office? Are they all looking for information and all calling you up at the same time?
Well, not quite at the same time. What we try to do is we try to do our work ahead of time. Our models that we use to forecast these events were very good, even earlier on last week. We were in coordination with the fire agencies to give them an idea of sometime during the night, on Saturday night, early Sunday morning, we should see the first onset of winds. And so we're calling them. They're calling us. We had fire officials within our office, actually, to get a kind of a briefing and a heads up on what we were expecting. We issue what are called red flag warnings. I'm sure you're aware of those. And those red flag warnings then are intended for fire agencies to use in order to adjust their staffing levels to prepare for an event like this.
Just so our audience around the country understands what's at stake, one person's already died in a fire near San Diego, four firefighters and at least 10 other people have been hospitalized, smoke inhalation being one of the major reasons. And I just wanted to point this out, Mark Jackson. A number of people, or a number of crews, rather, could not begin to fight the fires because they were too busy rescuing residents who refused to leave, wouldn't respond to the evacuation orders. How often does that happen?
It happens a lot. I've personally not been in one of those situations, but I can't imagine that when people are asked to leave their homes, it has to be a very devastating thing, and to decide what to take with them. And so I think because of that, just the aspect of home ownership, that I think people then feel as though they can stay there, they can fight this fire. We see the same thing with hurricanes, where people do not leave their homes, and unfortunately it can be very tragic. And so the same situation can happen here.
Just want to make another point, too, that we heard from the mayor of San Diego, who said that please don't use your cell phone in the San Diego area because the emergency personnel are using those. It's one of their primary means of communication. So let me just say to our audience around the country and around the world as well, that if you have friends in San Diego, this is probably not the right time to give them the call to make sure that everything is okay. And Mark Jackson, what about that? How difficult are communications in these very hilly areas with the wind raging and the fires blazing away?
It can be very difficult on top of the fact that with these strong winds, take away the fires, and with these strong winds, we have power outages, thousands of people without power, without any sort of phone contact. And so really a cell phone becomes their primary way to communicate. And so it can be very hectic out here. We have quite a few road closures throughout the area, which can then obviously result in extreme traffic in certain areas all throughout the city. And on top of all this, you've got smoke. We have smoke problems, air quality problems throughout a lot of the communities that aren't even really near fires. I can speak for Ventura County. We're getting smoke from a lot of the fires, the Ranch Fire, the Buckwheat Fire, that are miles, miles, and miles off to our east, but our air quality is really rather poor.
And you're up in the direction of Santa Barbara from Los Angeles.
We're toward Santa Barbara as you drive along the coast.
And again, the fires are raging all the way from there down to the Mexican border. And once again, how many days do you think this will be going on?
Right now, we're expecting our strong winds to continue through at least tomorrow afternoon. And with these winds, what typically happens is they'll maybe tail off a little bit during the afternoon, but then during the nighttime and early morning hours, they'll pick up again. So we expect really tonight and tomorrow morning to be almost as windy as it was this morning. The relative humidities today are actually lower than they were yesterday. Again, we have single-digit relative humidities throughout the area today, and so our burning indices, which is what they use for the fire agencies, are actually higher today. Wind should begin to tail off a little bit tomorrow afternoon, but then after that, we will have continued dry conditions. So we may not have the wind, we won't have the winds, but we'll still have the very low relative humidities. So critical fire conditions really are expected to continue almost all the way through almost Thursday night.
Okay, it looks like we're in for it in Southern California, and you can't exaggerate how fast those fires move and how erratic they are, and the way they pop up in one place and then suddenly appear somewhere else where you think everything's been fine. Now, Mark Jackson, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Meteorologist in charge of the National Weather Service Forecast Office for the Los Angeles region. No Child Left Behind is called President Bush's crowning domestic achievement, and it passed 5 years ago with support from liberal Democrats in both houses of Congress. Now it's up for renewal, and there is serious controversy this time around on Capitol Hill. David Hoff reports for Education Week, and David, thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
A very, very well-known enactment by Congress, No Child Left Behind. A lot of people around the country are very immediately involved with it. It has already expired, is that right, and is now up for renewal?
It technically has expired, but Congress did put in there, in the original law, a chance for it to automatically renew for the fiscal year that's already started, and so there'll be no interruption in money that goes out to schools, and the rules will stay the same. So it's actually in effect, even though it technically expired.
Committees of both houses of Congress set a deadline of September to try to put forward proposed changes in No Child Left Behind. They didn't make it. They're very different ones in the House and the Senate. What are the principal issues that are being discussed, the things that are causing the most controversy?
Well, the heart of the law really is about accountability and how to fix schools, and so that remains the biggest issues out there. The question of how is the federal government going to require states to judge whether their schools are being a success and whether or not it's going to prescribe particular interventions and which ones. For the schools that are not doing well. Now, there's also a side issue in here, and that is comes in to the efforts into building teacher quality, and there are proposals in a very early preliminary draft out of the House that would reward teachers or allow districts to reward teachers based on the success of students' test scores improving over time. That's something that's very controversial among teacher unions who see that as a violation of their right to bargain their own contracts locally, and they're fighting that very hard.
They went for it in New York City when Mayor Bloomberg agreed that the monetary rewards would go to the whole school, not to the individual teachers. How did that demollify the teachers' unions?
Well, New York City, that was part of the collective bargaining process. So the details of that merit pay system were agreed to by the union leadership in New York. I think one of the things the teacher union critics are saying in this process in federal law, that they would not have any say into what a district would propose in terms of a merit pay program coming out of the law.
So local control is a big issue in this whole area.
Oh, local control is the heart of any issue and any debate when it comes to federal K through 12 education.
What is the record on whether No Child Left Behind has been effective in raising test scores?
You know, there's really no direct link saying that it has. But it certainly, over the past 5 years, there does seem to be a general trend upwards, I would say. Several reports are pointing to it. More broadly, that there's been a trend upwards dating back 10 or 15 years. Some will point to data saying that, you know, there was something of a turning point in state test scores in the past 5 years since No Child Left Behind passed, and things accelerated. Others will point to the National Assessment of State Progress, saying that the growth was actually faster from the late 90s, mid-90s, into 2001, and it has slowed since 2001 when No Child Left Behind passed.
Okay, so a lot of conflicting data associated with this. President Bush has threatened to veto certain kinds of changes. What are they?
Well, the words he uses that anything that weakens accountability. Now, he didn't really define exactly what that is, but his people have said that he and his education secretary have said that they want any accountability system to test students at every grade, that the heart of the matter be reading and mathematics, and that schools not be giving ways to, I would think, to use their terminology, hide poor test scores by using other data measures.
Okay, David Hoff, again with Education Week. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Jeff Kuhner is Communications Director at the Fordham Institute. I just want to say, Jeff Kuhner, before I allow you to speak, we're going to have to go to a break very soon. But let me ask you, if I may, to first, if you will, just summarize the fact that you have been part of a study of No Child Left Behind. And tell us in the next minute or so, if you can, what are the major conclusions you reached?
Essentially, what we found is that there were very serious problems and flaws in No Child Left Behind. In particular, what we found is that state tests, these individual state testing systems, are very discrepant. They vary from state to state randomly, almost erratically. Some states have much tougher testing systems. The rigor of their tests is much harder. And other states, especially concentrated in the Midwest, Colorado, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, and even some other states like Texas, really have set the bar extremely low. And so what we're trying to highlight to policymakers is if you want greater transparency, if you want greater accountability, No Child Left Behind is going to have to be substantially overhauled.
All right. We'll come back. I hear more from Jeff Kuhner and other guests as we continue our conversation about No Child Left Behind and efforts to modify it in the very near future. On To The Point.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, talking again about No Child Left Behind, passed 5 years ago, now up for renewal, supposed at the outset to make every American child proficient in reading and math by 2014. Now we're hearing from Jeff Kuhner of the Fordham Institute that a study shows that different states have different ideas about what proficiency is. Does that make it very difficult then to judge whether No Child Left Behind is doing any good or not?
You hit the nail right on the head. That's exactly the point of our report, is that because every individual state can define proficiency on their own terms, there is no common definition of proficiency. So one of the examples, one of the most dramatic and egregious examples that we highlight in the report, is, say, the difference between a fourth-grade reading test in Wisconsin and a fourth-grade reading test in Massachusetts. A fourth grader in Wisconsin, to be deemed proficient in reading, simply has to be able to discern fact from opinion on this sentence. Cats climb trees better than dogs. You say fact, according to Wisconsin standards, you are deemed proficient. That very same student's peer in, let's say, Massachusetts, on their test, same fourth grader, has to analyze a complex passage from the great Russian novelist Leo Tolstoy, and then break it down sentence by sentence, analysis by analysis, to discern fact from opinion. The difference in the two tests are literally worlds apart. And so one of the inadvertent consequences of No Child Left Behind is that you're creating state-to-state inequities. You have certain states like California, like Massachusetts, like Washington, and surprisingly South Carolina, where the bar, in fact, has been set quite high from the third grade all the way to the eighth grade. And you have other states, Wisconsin being one of them, but there are many others, where literally the bar has been set very low, especially at the third and fourth grade level. And really, to us, the crisis here that's being unleashed by No Child Left Behind is that many of our elementary school students are being set up to fail. Because the one thing No Child Left Behind promised was transparency. That when little Sarah or little Timmy came home and showed their parents, you know, their third and fourth grade reading and math tests and says, hey, look, I've passed, you know, I'm proficient, that the parents would say, well, fine, little Sarah, little Timmy is doing great. And then as they progress through fifth, sixth, and seventh grade, what we're finding out is because the eighth grade tests are significantly more difficult than the third grade tests, many of those very same students are failing at the seventh and eighth grade level. And so policymakers now over the last couple of years have been asking themselves, is there a crisis in middle school? The crisis is not in middle school. The crisis is in, frankly, in elementary school at the third, fourth grade level, because we've set the bar so low, we are setting up our students to fail later on.
So obviously you would expect the eighth grade test to be more difficult than the fourth grade, but what you're saying is that they're proportionally much more difficult.
Right. Even assuming for normal development, obviously an eighth grade test is harder than a third grade test, but assuming normal development, it's sort of the way we discuss it in the report is it's like asking a child to climb up a set of steps, and the third and fourth step is only 6 inches high. But by the time they get to the seventh or eighth test, it's 2 feet high. And many of those students can't make it over that 2 feet, you know, that 2 feet barrier, because it's just, that's not something they've been accustomed to. So what we're strongly recommending for every state to do, and even to have national standards on this issue, is ask ourselves, what is it that we want and know our students that they should be able to do at the eighth grade level in terms of math, reading, science, writing, and other core curriculum? And then use that as an exit point and work backwards. So let's test them at the seventh, sixth, fifth, fourth, third grade level so they can progress normally and naturally onto the eighth grade, do well at those tests, and then hopefully move on to high school and a good, successful career in college.
Jeff Kuhner at the Fordham Institute, just off a study of No Child Left Behind. Dr. Monty Neal is co-executive director of the Massachusetts-based Fair Test Coalition, which advocates some very sweeping changes to No Child Left Behind, of a different sort than we've heard, I think. Dr. Neal, good to have you with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
First of all, you're in Massachusetts. Are you happy that your fourth grader is going to have to be able to analyze a passage from Tolstoy?
We're talking about a level of insanity here. When the test first came out in Massachusetts, people studied the fourth grade reading passages and found that, in fact, based on commonly used publisher definitions, there were no items that were at the fourth grade level. They were fifth, sixth, and above. So there was a sort of an immediate demand that all the kids read more than they'd ever been expected to. We're not opposed to steady improvement, but the notion that we are expecting the average fourth grader in the United States to read Tolstoy is absurd. So there does need to be a conversation about what we expect of our children, but we should not assume that just because a state has extremely difficult requirements, that therefore that's automatically the best.
Is it okay, then, that in fourth grade in Wisconsin, cats climb trees better than dogs is all you need to be able to analyze or identify as a fact?
If that's all that's required, that is, on the other side, I agree, a very low requirement.
So what about, then, establishing national standards? Does that make sense?
No, we don't think so. We think that the states, under pressure and under discussion among themselves, will steadily move toward more reasonable interpretations. Again, I emphasize the word reasonable. Low level isn't good, but you know, while it would be great for some fourth graders to read Tolstoy, having that as a common expectation is pretty absurd. So we also have to think about more than just reading and math. NCLB focuses on them. That's been the history of the federal law. But what we're finding across the country is that a lot of schools are scrapping science, history, art, phys ed, even recess gets cut out in order to boost multiple choice test scores in reading and math. That's actually hurting, not helping education. It may make it appear that things are getting better, but in the real world, it won't.
NCLB, of course, the abbreviation for No Child Left Behind. Well, President Bush, we just heard, is threatening to veto a bill if it expands beyond reading and math the requirements of No Child Left Behind, saying that schools can kind of hide behind these other subjects if they're allowed to do that, if you give them too much flexibility.
I don't know any reasonably educated parent that thinks that reading and math are the only things that should count. There's no evidence to say that the public believes that, or that certainly, you know, when you get to college, you've got to be able to do other things. And what we're finding is that not only are other subjects being eliminated, which parents are very unhappy about, and it's leading to a growing majority of people thinking the law needs major changes in this country, but also in reading and in math, those subjects are turning into test prep programs for mostly multiple choice tests. While the Massachusetts test is technically difficult, in fact, what we find in looking at it, it is not a test that does a good job of assessing more subtle intellectual skills that, in fact, our kids ought to be learning. Rather, it emphasizes more rote learning, albeit at sometimes a sophisticated level of reading passage.
Again, Dr. Monty Neal is with the Fair Test Coalition in Massachusetts as the co-executive director of that organization. Karen Chenoweth is senior writer with the Achievement Alliance, author of a book that would suggest a different attitude toward No Child Left Behind. It's called It's Being Done, Academic Success in Unexpected Schools. Karen Chenoweth, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
What do you say to what we have just heard? Our other two guests saying that act is failing in a multitude of ways.
Well, we have to go back to why No Child Left Behind was enacted. American schools were failing too many children, and so policymakers, and I think you noted that Senator Kennedy and Congressman Miller were among the leaders. They're hardly considered conservatives. They felt that there was a need to try and spur some better achievement, particularly among poor children and children of color. States had low standards or sometimes no standards before No Child Left Behind. It's not an artifact of No Child Left Behind that there are low standards in schools and in states in this country. We now have a lot more information about those standards because of No Child Left Behind, because it requires that students be tested from third through eighth grade and once in high school, and that every state participate in the National Assessment of Educational Progress. So for the first time, we have a little window onto how every school in the nation is doing. Parents can look at their state's website and pull up information about their kid's school, not only what percentage of students overall are achieving state standards, but also broken out by the major subgroups in the school, the African-American students, Latino students, low-income students. This is revolutionary among schools to have that kind of information. Do states game the system? Yes. Should we try and stop that? Yes. Do schools try and game the system? Absolutely. Should we try and set up some systems to stop that? Absolutely. But what I think people don't realize is how difficult it is to know what goes on in schools, and how for the first time we have a little bit of a window on what goes on in schools.
You certainly, though, can't really compare state by state, can you, if, in fact, the standards are so different, as we heard earlier from Jeff Cooner? In other words, if you're a parent, you want to know how your kid is doing, and you're in Wisconsin, you're not going to get a very good idea if you look at the test scores in Massachusetts.
No, and I think the information that we're getting as a result of No Child Left Behind should spur a lot of parents and a lot of community members in Wisconsin, in some of the other states that have very low standards, to say, wait a second. Don't tell me my kid is reading just fine when he won't be ready for college. I think that's absolutely one of the good things about No Child Left Behind, is that it is forcing this kind of national conversation about, well, what is it we want our kids to know? I mean, before No Child Left Behind, too many teachers were left with, go find the book in the book room and see what you can figure out to teach. Now it's much more purposeful, much more driven by standards than before. Is it right yet? No, I don't think it is right yet.
One question about accountability. It was supposed that under these circumstances, schools that failed for a certain period of time would be radically changed. Teachers would be fired, principals would be removed, reorganizations would occur. Recent story in the New York Times said some very large percentage of schools that fall into that category, I think 87% of failed schools, have avoided those kinds of changes. Why is that? And is that an argument for or against No Child Left Behind?
Well, most states don't want to take over schools because they don't know what to do any more than anybody else does. So there's a big disincentive for a state to take over a school. But where schools have been reconstituted, there have been tremendous improvements sometimes. And so it's not the end of the world to be reconstituted. It's not the end of the world to have a new principal and some new staff. I went to a school in St. Paul where under an agreement with the union, the city reconstituted the school, meaning that all the teachers had to reapply for their jobs. They put in a new principal. That school improved enormously over the next few years. And so I don't think it's not the end of the world to be reconstituted, and parents shouldn't think it's the end of the world. But it's a very drastic step, and you don't undertake that lightly. You do that only when it's very clear that many students are being terribly served by that particular school. You don't do it if more marginal or more incremental changes would help the school. Better professional development, more time for professional development. You know, if you can make those improvements without reconstituting a school, you're much better off and everybody's a lot happier.
Karen Chenoweth again, a senior writer with the Achievement Alliance, author of It's Being Done, Academic Success in Unexpected Schools. Let's talk to somebody who has made an extraordinary improvement in a school. A middle school number 124 in Queens, New York, was in the 30th percentile in 1999. Valerie Lewis was a teacher then. Now she is principal, and that school is up to the 80th percentile. Ms. Lewis, thank you very much for joining us.
Good afternoon.
You've got a Title I school. What does that mean?
Title I means we're federally funded. We have 100% of children at the poverty level receiving free lunch, and we get additional funding for that.
How many kids?
1,248.
How did you go from the 30th percentile to the 80th percentile, and is No Child Left Behind responsible?
In part, yes. Our children had leveled off, but it wasn't the accountability tests that were being given. We realized that there was not enough rigor in the instruction, and we investigated that and applied for a New York State grant and redid the whole curriculum in the building and adopted a reform model, E.D. Hirsch's Core Knowledge, which is a very rigorous program in pre-K all the way through grade 8 in English, science, math, social studies, and we infused it within the whole building and have gotten great success for it. And our children have grown, not only reached the state benchmarks, our 8th grade middle school students have soared and have gone into high schools for the most part, not in 9th grade, but have gone into 10th and 11th grade classes. And we attribute that to the core knowledge sequence and everything that we've done. But in listening to everybody today, and we were talking about accountability, what is proficient? If those children do well on an ELA and math test, that's not the well-rounded child. So we have pushed the rigor of instruction way before third grade. We started in pre-K. So these children are immersed in content-rich instruction. It has forced our teachers to be ongoing learners. It's forced all of us to improve our professional development. And the children have grown. And we've even, it's more than just the child, it's the parents. The parents come in for workshops. We've taken every issue, social, emotional, and all of the instructional issues and tied it with a big red bow. And that's why we're receiving the success that we've had.
Do the fourth graders have to know Tolstoy?
Not yet, but close to it. By sixth grade, they do, and they understand it.
What about cat climbs trees? Cats climb trees better than dogs. Are they doing...
No, that's very simplistic.
No.
No, we wouldn't even do that in kindergarten. You know, what the state tests are doing for all of us is to show in ELA, do the children master the skills? We go past skills. We go past what content knowledge do they have. In fourth grade, how can they debate the American Revolution? In fifth grade, they might do the Reformation. In kindergarten, they're going to do the Founding Fathers and the Constitution and be able to have dialogue on it, even way before they can read.
Do you have a lot of kids whose original language is not English?
More so now than ever before, and that is a problem.
And yet you have been able to make these changes, but you certainly can't attribute them all to No Child Left Behind. You've done a lot on your own.
I think that it came in simultaneously. We had started before NCLB, but a lot of that was looking at the state standards at the time, New York state standards, and seeing what were we going to do to get children just past what they needed to know. And that's where core knowledge came in. So when I listen to everybody, and I have colleagues across the country, and we debate this all the time, it's not even the state standards. It's more the rigor of instruction that we're providing children.
Again, Valerie Lewis is principal at middle school number 124 in Queens, New York. We will come back in a moment to see what our other guests have to say about what we just heard about the extraordinary changes that have taken place there. On To The Point from PRI.
For more information about To The Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To The Point.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. We've just heard an extraordinary story from Valerie Lewis at Middle School 124 in Queens, which is an 100% Title I school, gets federal funds, a low income level, and where dramatic changes have been made. Let me go first to Dr. Monty Neal at the Fair Test Coalition in Massachusetts. Is this a model, do you think, that could be adopted elsewhere, or is this something that required the initiative and enterprise of Valerie Lewis and the teachers at 124?
Well, she seems to have done remarkable things, the teachers there have. There are other schools around the country, certainly, where that's true, using different kinds of approaches, but what they have in common is a collaborative effort among the faculty, strong expectations, a rich, powerful kind of curriculum, a very emotionally and socially supportive environment, access to the tools and resources that kids need. It's been very hard, in fact, so far essentially not done, to bring these kinds of efforts up to a large scale. What we have, unfortunately, is not a concerted federal effort to figure out how to help local schools and districts do that, but a set of procedures that focus inordinate attention on test scores and then threaten and punish the teachers. That's no way to get the kind of improvement that's needed. The professional development requirements in the current federal law are basically a mishmash of junk. Our alliance, the Forum on Educational Accountability, has proposed really streamlining and focusing and greatly expanding the funding so that the kind of professional development that our principal talked about can be done more extensively in Title I schools across the country. And we have a set of other recommendations there at fairtest.org and other websites in our member organizations.
But Valerie Lewis, back to you at Middle School 124. You're a supporter of No Child Left Behind, are you not?
Yes.
Why? So it's not getting in the way, at least.
Because children shouldn't come from failing schools. And when we get children from failing schools, we see what we can do with them. Every child has the right to an education. My problem with NCLB is that there is no equitable benchmark across the board. When we spoke earlier about testing tools and everything, teachers are getting now second-guessing themselves because the accountability is the thing that's out there, not the knowledge base. And until we do that and focus on the knowledge base, there's going to be a problem.
Do the teachers tend to want to teach to the test, as we hear so often is the case, because they're fearful that they'll be disciplined if their kids don't improve?
Not here.
But is that
a problem? We look at the whole child. It is a problem. It is a systemic problem in New York City, more so than ever before.
And as a result of No Child Left Behind?
As a result of No Child Left Behind, most definitely.
So mixed reviews then from you?
Mixed reviews. But we don't look at NCLB in and of itself or the test in and of itself. We just look at best practices and how to educate children and differentiate instruction for the teachers, for the children, for everything else, so that we can get where we need to go.
Jeff Kuhner, let me go back to you at the Fordham Institute, having completed the study on No Child Left Behind, NCLB. What's your take on what we've heard from Valerie Lewis?
I think Valerie Lewis is a hero. I think she's a modern-day hero. I think she's one of the people on the front lines of the education wars, and it's a classic example of what really empowering principals and giving them the autonomy that they need to really improve the quality of education, and it just shows how effectively it can work. And, you know, Warren, I think the larger point that we at the Fordham Institute want to make is that higher standards and setting the bar as high as possible leads to higher performance and higher achievement. It inspires and pushes teachers to work harder and do better, and inspires students to work harder and better. And that's why we believe in the end, I mean, I really agree with Valerie. I would give No Child Left Behind mixed reviews. We support standards-based reform. We think it's the way to go. But ultimately, we think you need to have a common national definition of proficiency across the board, not just for reading and math, but even for other core curriculum like science, like history, like biology. And we believe that in the end, you need to have a 21st century education model for this country. In Europe and across Asia, our rivals and our competitors are embracing national standards and national testing. We believe it's time, the idea is time has come, to have a uniform, rigorous, comprehensive test and standard across the board, so it's equitable and fair to every student in this country, and that everyone should be expected to learn the basic same things right across the board, whether it's Wisconsin or Massachusetts or California.
Isn't it contradictory to say, on the one hand, that we have to empower the principals and to give more local control to them and allow them to exercise the kind of creativity we've heard about, and at the same time, to say that we need national standards?
I mean, Warren, not really. On the surface, probably yes. But no, what we're saying is set the benchmarks, set the goals, and then give the principals and the local school districts the autonomy and the flexibility to reach those benchmarks and goals. What we have now is almost the exact reverse. There is a lot of federal intervention in schools at all levels. Principals' hands are tied on so many issues in terms of what they can do, what they can't do, and yet there is no common standard. And so what we're basically saying is simplify the standards, make it national, make it comprehensive, make it rigorous, make it uniform, and then give the teachers and the principals the tools and the means that they need to reach those standards.
Karen Chenoweth, let me go back to you. We found out about Valerie Lewis from your book, It's Being Done, Academic Success in Unexpected Schools. How many places can tell us the kind of story that we heard from Valerie Lewis?
Well, not enough, but there are quite a few. I have to say I fell in love with Osmond Church, with Valerie Lewis's school. It sort of sets new standards for what is possible, I think. And it demonstrates that teaching to the test is not the way to go. Teaching a deep, rich curriculum tied to standards will allow kids to easily pass the fairly low-level reading and math tests that are required by the states. There's a wonderful book that's going to come out by a cognitive scientist named Daniel Willingham, who I think will really help establish that reading is not a skill unto itself. You need a lot of background knowledge in order to understand what you're reading. If you want to read a newspaper article, you really need a lot of background knowledge in social studies, science, and so forth. And so we need all those curricula We need all those content areas in order for kids to learn how to read.
Very quickly, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but Dr. Monty Neal, I just want to ask you one more question. Now, how do we make No Child Left Behind a floor instead of a ceiling? It seems to me that's one of the potential problems here. If you set national standards, that's all anybody does, and all they do is give tests on in reading and math, clearly, according to Valerie Lewis and others, so that's not enough.
Well, the problem is that we have a law. The federal government has decided what it should do is impose accountability through essentially reinforcing mostly bad state tests. Congress needs to really rethink what it's doing in education in order to provide primarily support to schools along with a push. Outcome results are important. They must be part of the mix, but they can't be reduced to just standardized test scores in a couple of subjects. Or once one attaches accountability to that, what you get is what Valerie talked about, which is the danger that more and more teachers feel compelled and threatened to focus just on the tests instead of having, you know, instead of really overhauling the curriculum and the instruction, which is often what needs to be done.
All right. We've heard a sort of primer on the kind of debate that ought to occur. We'll see what's going on Capitol Hill as the days go by. Thanks to all of you for being with us. Dr. Monty Neal, the Massachusetts Fair Test Coalition, Jeff Kooner with the Fordham Institute, Karen Chenoweth of the Achievement Alliance, David Hoff, our earlier guest with Education Week, and Valerie Lewis of PS number 124 in Queens. So thanks very much to all of you for being with us today. Today's program produced by Dan Konecki with Karen Radziner and Francis Anderton. Our technical director is Mike Newport. For more information about To the Point or to email us, visit kcrw.com/To the Point. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.